Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The election of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani in June was perceived throughout the West as a possible reset moment in U.S.-Western relations with that Islamic State. Well, since that time, tensions have been aggravated by the ongoing conflict in Syria, an Iranian ally, the use of chemical weapons there. But since Rouhani took office in August, the signs have seemed positive that Iranian-Western relations are changing for the better. You have to look no further than today's New York Times. There's an article today that Iran's leaders are seeking a swift agreement on the country's nuclear program with hopes that Western sanctions will be lifted. Those sanctions have been crippling to the Iranian economy. My guest today has been following Iran for a number of years. Barbara Slavin is a veteran journalist who's a senior fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council. She's currently the Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com, a website devoted to news from and about the Middle East. She's previously served as an assistant managing editor for World and National Security at the Washington Times, a senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today, Cairo correspondent for The Economist, and an editor at the New York Times Week in Review. She's also the author of the 2007 book Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Barbara Slavin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Rich. Nice to be here.
While most of our attention has been focused on Syria, Iran has had presidential elections over the summer, which was covered here in the United States, but it resulted in a new president, Hassan Rouhani, who was viewed, at least from that group of candidates, as the moderate of the bunch. And with his elections, there's some hope that our relationship between the United States and Iran would change. But for every observer who says this could be a new start, there's another one that says it's not going to change a thing. Now, he's been in office for about 6 weeks now. Are things changing? Are they going to stay the same? Or is the jury still out?
Well, the jury is still out in the sense that this is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Certain aspects of it are not going to change rapidly, I think. But the early indications are quite positive. He came in prepared to do this job. This is somebody with a unique resume in the Islamic Republic. He has been on the Supreme Council of National Security, their National Security Council, for 23 years as representative of the real power in the country, the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, also a cleric. He's the one who has the final decision on everything. But Rouhani has been Khamenei's representative on this National Security Council for 23 years. Rouhani is on a number of other very influential bodies in Iran, the Expediency Council, the Assembly of Experts. I can explain what these are if you really
need
to know.
That would be
he
useful.
Was in Parliament. He was Deputy Speaker of Parliament. He was Iran's chief nuclear negotiator from 2003 to 2005. So this is somebody who has been there and done that in a way that very few others in that system have done. You called him a moderate. In relative terms, I suppose, but what I see him as really as a very experienced apparatchik in the Islamic system, somebody who has a potential to actually begin to change things because he knows the system so well and because his relationship with the real power, the supreme leader, is so close.
Let me ask you, rather than describing him as a moderate, maybe it would be best to describe him as a pragmatist?
A pragmatist and a very experienced bureaucrat and diplomat.
Now, you mentioned the councils, and this is the thing that we don't understand about Iranian politics. You know, you have a legislature, you have a judiciary, and, of course, you have the cleric council, you have the administration, if you will. But you have all these councils that sort of advise all these groups, which makes it very, it's very difficult for a person used to Western democracy to understand.
Indeed. The Assembly of Experts, this is a group of about 86 clerics that chooses the supreme leader of the country and is supposed to supervise the supreme leader of the country. So to be a member of that, that's quite significant. There's the Expediency Council. This is a group that's supposed to mediate disputes between the legislature and the executive branch. So yes, you have all these little centers of power. Some of these assemblies and committees are places where you park officials after they're no longer that relevant. And so it's not always the position itself. It's often the person who occupies that position that makes the difference.
But I would think that would make change very difficult in a country like Iran.
Yes and no. I think what I really sensed, and I've been going now, I've gone nine times since 1996. You know, the country has evolved, the society has evolved, the people have evolved, and there has been tremendous frustration, particularly under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, with the direction that Iran was going in. And of course, a lot of anger at the economic sanctions and the really poor state of the Iranian economy. So it's partly who Rouhani is, but it's also when he has come to power. He's come to power at a time when Iranian society is crying out for change, at least for relief from these terrible economic sanctions. And how do you get relief from sanctions? You have to make a deal on the nuclear issue. There is no other way out. So in a sense, I think he does have a consensus behind him. He clearly has a majority of those who voted in these elections. It was quite stunning that he got more than 50% of the vote in a race in which there were six candidates running at the end. So that's pretty substantial. And he keeps saying that he understands what Iranians want, and he's going to, you know, he's going to fulfill his promises to the Iranian people. That's what he says.
Now, when we have a presidential candidate like that, he refers to himself as having a mandate.
A mandate. He does.
Well,
yes,
Rouhani probably wouldn't put it that way in Iran, but is that the way he's approaching things?
Actually, I think he's even used the word mandate. Mm-hmm. I think he clearly feels that. You know, the Iranian system went through a real crisis of legitimacy in 2009. That was the last presidential election.
Very disputed presidential
election.
Very
disputed. And Ahmadinejad was declared the victor with 63% of the vote, and nobody believed it. There had been a real groundswell of support for another candidate, a more moderate, in this case, candidate named Mousavi. And after the results were announced at, you know, obscenely early, I think the polls hadn't even closed all over Iran. They already announced that Ahmadinejad won. There were huge protests, the biggest protest demonstration since the 1979 revolution. And people were arrested. Thousands were arrested. About 100 were killed. It wasn't like Syria, but it was bad. It was a real, real threat to the system, and it was shaken to its core. So I think for the supreme leader and the rest of the political elite, there was a tremendous sigh of relief after these elections that even though people weren't ecstatic about Rouhani, I mean, they voted for him as the least worst of the candidates. That's how I would describe it. People were satisfied. There were some celebrations in the streets afterwards. Things were quiet. And when you look at the Middle East now, my God, with Syria in flames, Egypt, coups, real problems almost everywhere you look, Lebanon, bombs going off again. I have said, I've written that Iran is kind of a bright spot in relative terms in that part of the world right now, which is astonishing when you consider where they were in 2009. So there's a sense that the regime as a whole is pleased that Rouhani has been accepted by the people. And he has, so I think he has a mandate, a popular mandate, but also a mandate from the rest of the regime to try to do something, try to fix some of these problems, to certainly improve the relationship with the outside world, which was, let's face it, I mean, just a wreck after Ahmadinejad and his stupid statements about the Holocaust and Israel and so on. So a lot of work has to be done, and we see Rouhani doing it. I mean, he's giving interviews to NBC. He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. He's talking about constructive engagement and no zero-sum games and a win-win for everyone. He has great media advisors, needless to say. So we'll see now whether this charm offensive can be translated into something concrete.
I think I read from you that he's released a lot of those political prisoners that were imprisoned after 2009.
Well, typically Iranian presidents release some political prisoners before they come to the UN every September.
Yeah.
Ahmadinejad did it too. And even Mohammad Khatami, who was the last reformist president, I remember the first time he came to the UN in 1998, he announced that Iran would not actively support implementation of a fatwa against the British author Salman Rushdie. You may remember that Ayatollah Khomeini, the leader of the Iranian Revolution, just before he died, pronounced a death sentence on Salman Rushdie.
Verses,
and a fatwa, they call it, Islamic ruling. So this was very controversial, needless to say. And the first thing, one of the first things that Khatami did when he came to the UN in 1998 was say, in a sense, that this fatwa was no longer operative, even though he couldn't cancel it, because only Khomeini could do that, and Khomeini was dead. But, you know, that was his way of sort of doing that. And then Ahmadinejad, you know, there were always a couple of political prisoners. You may remember the American hikers who were held, who crossed the Iran-Iraq
border
they were held for a while in Iran. They were freed before Ahmadinejad came in 2011. So that wasn't new. But this time they released 11 people, and they were all human rights advocates, civil society advocates from within Iran. So I think this was also a gesture to say, let's put 2009 behind us. You know, let's bring everybody on board. Mind you, the two main candidates who opposed Ahmadinejad in 2009 are still under house arrest, Mousavi and Karoubi. So everybody's waiting to see when they will also be freed, and I think it's expected that they will be soon.
Now, you mentioned that President Rouhani went on American networks and talked about constructive engagement vis-a-vis the West. What does constructive engagement look like from an Iranian perspective?
Yeah, he also said Iran would never develop nuclear weapons, which was a rather important thing to say. I think, you know, he explained it actually in the op-ed that was written in the Washington Post. It means that Iran will not forfeit its own national interests. It will defend its national interests. But it believes in talking to others and trying to find solutions to problems, nonviolent solutions to problems. That's what he said. And Iran is making a big bid now to be part of diplomacy on Syria, to try to bring a ceasefire in this hideous war, which has killed more than 100,000 people. And, you know, Iran has been strongly supporting the Assad regime. But Iran, I think, there's been a big downside of Syria for Iran because it's increased sectarianism in the region between the majority Sunnis and the minority Shiites. Iran, of course, is a Shiite nation, and Assad is an Alawite, which is kind of an offshoot of Shiism. But he's fighting Sunnis, and many of them are Sunni fundamentalists. So there's been terrible sectarianism in the region. This hurts Iran's interests. And this chemical weapons business has really been very controversial for the Iranians because of their own experience being at the wrong end of those things during the Iran-Iraq War.
I was interested in pursuing that because being on the end of it in the Iran-Iraq War, you would think that that was going to sway public opinion against Syria significantly for support from the Iranian regime. Has there been any backlash?
Oh, yeah. I mean, frankly, even a year ago when I was in Iran, there was very little support among the Iranian people for Assad. You have to understand that most Iranians could care less about what goes on in Syria or Palestine or Lebanon. To them, this is all a waste of very precious Iranian hard currency to be supporting what they consider to be Arab causes. Iranians are not Arabs.
They're Persians.
Persians. A lot of people don't understand the ethnic differences, which are huge. You know, they're Turks, Arabs, Persians, three major ethnic groups. And historically, they haven't gotten along very well, particularly Arabs and Persians are oil and water. So for Iranians, it's, why are you spending my money? You know, it's sort of the way some Americans think about foreign aid
in this
country, but really magnified because Iran now is under sanctions. It doesn't have as much hard currency as it used to. Why are you spending my money propping up, you know, an Arab dictator here and a terrorist group there? You know, what is it to do with me? So that was the feeling a year ago. You can imagine now with the chemical weapons charges how people feel. And now we begin to see, even within the political elite in Iran, that they're distancing themselves from Assad. They don't come out and openly say that they believe he was responsible, but privately they will tell you that they do. And I think this gives them an out. And I actually wrote a piece about this I think it's on the Voice of America news website, voanews.com, about how the Iranians might look for a sort of Karzai-like solution. You know, the Iranians helped pick Hamid Karzai to be the president of Afghanistan, and they helped the U.S. get rid of the Taliban after 2001. And so if they could find a Sunni Syrian, a Syrian Karzai, you know,
somebody they could do business with.
Somebody they could do business with who would protect Iran's ties with Hezbollah in Lebanon and not be hostile to the Iranian government. I think they would be just as happy to push Assad and his family to one side and say, go find yourself a nice, you know, dacha outside Moscow and, you know, or we have a nice place for you to live in Iran if you would like. I don't think he would go to Iran. Yeah. I don't think his British-born wife, Asma, would like it very much, frankly. But there are solutions to be had here. And, of course, the Russians now have a huge stake in this diplomatic effort to disarm Assad, to keep the United States from attacking Syria. So one does begin to see elements of a diplomatic deal there. And, you know, if they can work on that, they can work on the nuclear issue too, and it all may fit together. This is a very optimistic scenario, mind you. I mean, we've got a long way to go.
My guest today is Barbara Slavin, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center. She also is a Washington foreign correspondent for Al Monitor, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. She was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking about Iran's new president and what that means for U.S.-Iranian relations. We want to get to Syria in a moment, but one of the things the Obama administration has done in its handling of Syria as sort of said, if we don't confront Syria, how are we ever going to get Iran? And you've said this is a major mistake, conflating the two. Mm-hmm. How is Iran reacting to that?
Well, you know, had the United States gone and done a couple of cruise missile strikes right after this chemical weapons incident, I don't think the damage would have been that bad, frankly. And I was among those who thought actually the U.S. should do it because it was such a heinous act, killing all those civilians. And the United States is supposed to stand for something, you know. But as the time went on, and then Obama kind of punted after the British refused to support us and then pushed it off into Congress, and then we saw this reaction in Congress, which was so extremely anti-war. I mean, it was stunning.
Well, the people, I think the American
stunning.
People.
The American people didn't even want, you know, what John Kerry called unbelievably small strikes. They didn't want us to do anything that would involve the United States in Syria. After we had that, you know, I'm frankly glad now that we didn't hit Syria because I think that this diplomatic process will deter Assad from using chemical weapons again. And I think it does make it easier for the Iranians to engage with us on Syria and also on the nuclear question. I think Iran would have gotten over it if we'd done it quickly. But, you know, this would have been bad. So now it would have interfered with the UN General Assembly, which is coming up next week, and the potential for meetings between American and Iranian officials. So just as well, frankly, that we didn't strike and that we do have this diplomatic opening. But they are two different situations. And what I argued in the articles was that just because we send a couple of cruise missile strikes against Syria, you know, it isn't going to necessarily have any impact on Iran or whether they think we will or will not react to a nuclear weapons program there.
Now, your earlier assessment of the, I think you said the very optimistic future for Syria means that Assad leaves and goes somewhere to a beach or, you know, but really he's used chemical weapons. Is it realistic to think that he's going to end up on the beach or in The Hague?
Well, hopefully in The Hague, you know, but I think for the sake of a ceasefire, it might be possible to let him step down. Syria is supposed to have elections next year, presidential elections. So one way would be for him simply to choose not to run for a third term. And this has been suggested by Iranians. So that he wouldn't be forced out, he wouldn't be shot or beaten to death like Gaddafi was. It wouldn't look like regime change. It would look like an orderly political process. So everybody could save face in this. And then later on you could indict him and send him to The Hague, you know, kind of like what happened to Milosevic, I guess, in Serbia.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the Iranian nuclear program. Mm-hmm. Rouhani has been the chief negotiator, so he knows what our positions are, at least they were in the middle of the last decade. Does he feel like he can get a deal with the West?
I think he's motivated to try, and they've already, Iranian officials have already floated a number of ideas suggesting that they'd be willing to limit the number of centrifuges and the quality of the enriched uranium, that kind of thing, also permit much more intrusive inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency as a possible way to resolve the issue and get the United States to agree to allow them to continue to have a limited uranium enrichment program.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that our position, that we understand that they probably want to develop nuclear energy? Are we willing to allow them to develop nuclear energy, but just nothing beyond that?
U.S. hasn't said that it's willing to let them have any enrichment program.
That's been my sense, is that we say stop it.
this is bargaining. This is bargaining. The Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu had some comments recently where he's listed four conditions, you know, all, and he's not going to get that. I mean, no enrichment, no stockpiles, et cetera, et cetera. So there will be bargaining that goes on, and whatever. I mean, if they get a deal, it's going to be better than the current situation where Iran is continuing to amass ever larger quantities of ever higher enriched uranium.
Do you think, you know, the Iranian regime is, I'm sure it considers its sovereignty very important to them, just as any nation would. Are they probably willing to allow the unfettered access that the West is going to demand for any continuing enrichment?
You know, most people don't know, but UN inspectors are already on the ground 365 days a year in Iran. I recently interviewed, actually, for Al Monitor, the head of safeguards for the International Atomic Energy Agency. And there are inspectors who visit every Iranian declared nuclear facility pretty much once a week. So it's already quite intrusive. But you could do more. You could put in cameras, remote cameras, so that the folks in Vienna at the IAEA headquarters could monitor 24/7 everything that goes on, and they could see if any materials were diverted or seals were broken or that sort of thing. And that would make it very hard for Iran to break out of this regime and actually build nuclear weapons.
If I remember right, in Iraq, that one of the big things was surprise inspections of sites that were not necessarily declared nuclear sites or chemical sites.
Yeah, I don't know that Iran would permit that level. But, you know, according to our intelligence agencies, Iran has not made a decision to actually produce nuclear weapons. What the Iranians have already is a nuclear weapons capability, which means they could build them within a fairly short time if they wanted. But that's a political decision. And so if we make it worth their while not to take that political decision, I think there's a pretty good feeling that, yeah, they might cheat a little bit around the edges, but they would not actually go and build weapons. The Iranians themselves, some of their best minds, have argued that it would not be in Iran's strategic interest to actually possess nuclear weapons, because if they do, then the Saudis will want them, the Turks will want them, so on and so forth. And Iran would be outrun in a nuclear arms race.
Mm-hmm. Do they fear Pakistani nuclear capabilities at all?
I don't know that they fear them. I mean, they have reasonable relations with Pakistan. They might fear that Pakistan would sell some of its nuclear weapons to Saudi Arabia in the event that Iran had them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it just seems like a few years ago, Iran said the right to an unfettered nuclear program was, you know, a key part of national sovereignty, and they would just not give it up.
Yeah.
Has that really changed that much so quickly?
Well, they can say that their right, so-called, to enrich uranium has been recognized, and that the world, you know, I mean, it's very easy to spin this if you're the Iranian government. Very easy. It all depends on how it's choreographed.
My guest today is Barbara Slavin, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last evening, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. The United Nations is coming up here in the next week. I believe the new president will be speaking. Is he looking on this as a major occasion to sort of reset the Iranian relationship with the West?
Yes, and yes. He's giving three speeches. He'll address the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. He's going to talk to a disarmament summit, and he's going to talk to a meeting of the senior officials of the non-aligned movement, which Iran currently chairs. He's also going to have a big on-the-record meeting at the Asia Society that I'm going to be going to, and then off-record meetings with journalists, big interviews in addition to the NBC interview he did. I think he's going to be seeing Charlie Rose and Christian Amanpour, so he's going to have multiple ways to get his message out.
Any chance he's going to meet with Obama administration officials?
Yeah, I think he and Obama will have a meet and greet in the corridor of the UN General Assembly, maybe, or at the luncheon for the heads of state that the Secretary General of the UN gives every year. There will be a chance for them to acknowledge each other, I think.
Now, how important is this to the United States at this point, though? Because, you know, for a while it was incredibly important, and now in the last year or so, it just seems like it's just not been all that important, at least in their official talking points.
Oh, I think the U.S. has a tremendous interest in trying to resolve the nuclear issue. This is a major foreign policy issue for the Obama administration and a major cause of friction with a number of countries. It's of concern to the Israelis, to the Europeans. It's a very big deal.
Mm-hmm. Now, beyond the nuclear issue, there's always been a lot of other issues with Iran that the United States has had, whether it's supporting Hezbollah or other what we would call terrorist organizations. Does that get in the way? Even if you might get a deal on the nuclear program, is it possible that there'll still be issues over other issues that would keep sanctions in place?
Very much so. And I think the Iranians understand that the U.S. sanctions are not all going to magically come off if they get a nuclear deal. But the Obama administration has some flexibility the president can waive or suspend a number of the sanctions that are related to the nuclear question. And the Europeans, of course, could start buying Iranian oil again, which would be huge, because the real blow has come in the last year when the Europeans stopped buying Iranian oil. Exports are down by half now.
Mm-hmm. Now, how big a bite has sanctions had on the Iranian economy?
It's been terrible. It's been absolutely terrible. I mentioned the exports being down. The value of the Iranian currency, the rial, is about one-fifth of what it was just a couple of years ago. Inflation is very high, over 50%. Unemployment is very bad. So they desperately need some relief.
Mm-hmm. Now, if Rouhani is not able to get a deal, is the forces likely to turn against him pretty quickly? I mean, is it in the West interest to keep Rouhani there and, in a sense, make a deal?
Yeah, the honeymoon will be short, I think, both domestically and internationally. So he has to show some real results soon. And I would think it would be in our interest, because we don't want to return to Ahmadinejad and to those points of view. I think it's going to be delicate, and obviously you can't rush into this, but we've been working at this a long time. The issues are very well known to both sides, and I should mention that the Iranian foreign ministry is going to be responsible now for the negotiations, and the foreign minister is someone who spent more of his life in the United States than in Iran. His name is Mohammad Javad Zarif, graduate of a college in San Francisco and of the University of Denver, former Iranian UN ambassador. He has a better knowledge of international law, I think, than President Obama. So they have a very qualified chief negotiator, which means the negotiations will be tough. They'll be challenging, but potentially more productive than they have been over the last couple of years.
Now, if Ahmadinejad's power base is sort of, I would think, nascent at this point, I mean, you know, not very readily apparent, are they retooling, or if they don't see success early on, will that power base sort of rise up again? What do you think?
Not immediately. I think everything will depend on the relationship between the supreme leader and Rouhani. As I mentioned, it's very close. Iranian friends have told me they think that Rouhani has about 6 or 7 months to
deliver.
That's
not long.
It's not long to begin to see progress. If there's progress, that honeymoon can go on a little bit longer. But if he doesn't achieve progress, then you probably are going to see a bit of a retrenchment on the Iranian side, and they might start doing some rather provocative things to try to gain leverage over the United States. So this is going to be a very important period going forward.
A lot of times it takes 6 months just to get the United States' attention.
No. As I said, they've been these so-called P5 plus one talks,
yes,
that have been going on and
mm-hmm.
on and on.
Yeah.
The issues are well known. I think everybody has already in the back of their mind their various plan A, B, and C, their fallback positions and so on. So it might not take as long as we think. There might actually be a couple of breakthroughs very early on if all things go well.
All right. Well, we'll wait and see. Barbara Slavin, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Journalist Barbara Slavin was our guest today on Studio Tulsa. She's currently a senior fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council and the Washington correspondent for OwlMonitor.com. She's also the author of the 2007 book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and you can search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.